The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
What I would say is what we view as the most dangerous threat to Americans today is largely lone actors, some cases small cells, if you will, largely radicalized online, already here in the United States, attacking soft targets, using crude, readily accessible weapons, motivated either by jihadist inspirations or by a variety of domestic inspirations. So we have the HVEs, the homegrown violent extremists, which are the jihadist-inspired, and we have the DVEs, the domestic violent extremists, who are inspired by domestic sources. That bucket, which have a lot in common with each other, is the greatest threat, the greatest terrorism threat we face as a country.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, March 3rd, 2021. FBI Director Christopher A. Wray faced the Senate Judiciary Committee today to talk about the January 6th riot and insurrection. There was a lot of nonsense in the hearing, opening statements, repetitive questions, and we got rid of it all for you. Every question and every answer is in what follows only once. The hearing covered whether the FBI had intelligence that the riot was planned for January 6th, how it communicated what it knew to the Capitol Police and the Metropolitan Police. It also covered a bunch of other things, from solar wind to diversity at the FBI. Here it is, with all the nonsense stripped out. It's the Lawfare Podcast, March 3rd, Chris Wray versus the committee with no bull.
There's a lot of confusion about the planning and coordination by federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies in the days leading up to the attack on the Capitol. I was surprised to learn the FBI did not issue a threat assessment before January 6th, especially because the FBI's Norfolk, Virginia field office had uncovered specific threats against members of Congress, maps of the tunnel system under the Capitol complex, and places to meet before traveling together to Washington. I was also surprised to hear Acting D.C. Metropolitan Police Department Chief Robert Conti say that his information was only conveyed to the MPD in an email at 7 p.m. the night before January 6th. Chief Conti acknowledged that the information was raw intelligence, but said he would think, quote, something as violent as an insurrection at the Capitol would warrant a phone call or something, close quote. So it comes down to the basic question of what the FBI knew, when they knew it, whether they shared it, why this didn't rise to the level of a threat assessment.
So, Mr. Chairman, I welcome the question. You touched on a number of points there. So first, let me say that we were, in the period up leading up to January 6th, tracking a large amount of information about large numbers of people coming to participate in protests and about the potential for violence. The one specific piece of information that you refer to, the information from our Norfolk field office, has gotten a lot of attention. So this was a what's called a situational information report. It was prepared by our Norfolk field office specifically for dissemination. It was, as you noted, raw, unverified, uncorroborated information that had been posted online. And my understanding was that that information was quickly, as in within an hour, disseminated and communicated with our partners, including the U.S. Capitol Police, including Metro PD, not one, not two, but three different ways.
When can you be more specific
on
time?
Three different ways. So first, there was an email, as you said, to our Joint Terrorism Task Force, which includes task force officers specifically selected by their chiefs who participate on the Joint Terrorism Task Force, is for the very reason to be that chief's, that department's eyes and ears, so that they get the information real time, their departments do. So that's the first piece. Second, in addition to the email, verbally, through the command post briefing that we had, because we had stood up command posts both in the Washington field office and at headquarters, and those command posts included, again, representatives of the relevant agencies, Capitol Police, MPD, et cetera. Verbally, the same information was walked through again. And third, in addition to the email, in addition to the verbal briefing at the command post, the information was posted on what we call LEAP, which is a law enforcement portal, which is made available to law enforcement, not just here in the National Capital Region, but all around the country. Now, again, the information was raw. It was unverified. In a perfect world, we would have taken longer to be able to figure out whether it was reliable, but we made the judgment, our folks made the judgment, to get that information to the relevant people as quickly as possible, like I said, three different ways in order to leave as little as possible to chance. Now, I didn't see the report myself even until after the 6th, but the way in which it handled, at least as I understand it, strikes me as consistent with our normal process.
I just have a minute left, but I want to address what I consider the next big lie after the lie that the president really won on November 3rd, President Trump. The next big lie appears to be the argument that somehow or another those were not Trump supporters who invaded the Capitol. It made the rounds on the internet right before they came into the building and has been gaining momentum ever since. I'd like to ask you, Director Ree, do you agree that the Capitol attack involved white supremacists and other violent extremists?
Certainly the Capitol attack involved violent extremists. As I said, we, the FBI, consider this a form of domestic terrorism. It included a variety of backgrounds. Certainly there were quite a number. We're seeing quite a number as we're building out the cases on the individuals we've arrested for the violence. Quite a number who what we would call sort of militia violent extremists. So we've got a number who self-identify with, you know, the Proud Boys or the Oath Keepers, things like that. We also have a couple of instances where we've already identified individuals involved in the criminal behavior who we would put in the racially motivated violent extremists who advocate for what you would call sort of white supremacy. So there have been some of those individuals as well. One of the things that's happening as part of this is that as we build out the cases on the individuals, when we arrest them for the violence, we're getting a richer and richer understanding of different people's motivations. But certainly, as I said, militia violent extremism, some instances of racially motivated violent extremism, specifically advocating for the superior of the white race.
Based on your investigation so far, do you have any evidence that the Capitol attack was organized by, quote, fake Trump protesters?
We have not seen evidence of that at this stage, certainly.
Thank you. Senator Grassley.
Yeah. We all want to know what happened to Officer Brian Sicknick. Tragic death as a result of that January 6th assault. There's been conflicting reports about his cause of death. Have you determined the exact cause of death? And is there a homicide investigation?
So I'll take the last part of your question first. There is an ongoing investigation into his death. I have to be careful at this stage, because it's ongoing, not to get out in front of it. But I certainly understand and respect and appreciate the keen interest in what happened to him. After all, he was here protecting all of you. And as soon as there are information that we can appropriately share, we want to be able to do that. But at the moment, the investigation is still ongoing.
So does that mean, since the investigation is going on, you have not determined the exact cause of the death?
That means we can't yet disclose a cause of death at this stage.
But you have determined the cause of death.
I didn't say that. We're not at a point where we can disclose or confirm a cause of death.
It's important for the committee to fully understand the FBI's caseload regarding domestic extremism cases. I have a series of data-driven and data-centered questions for you that I'll give a list of these in sequence. I'd prefer the answers now, but if you don't have them, I'll accept those answers after the hearing as long as you commit to do so. So this is a series of questions. What percentage of your investigation regarding January 6th are predicated as racially motivated violent extremists or white supremacist originated individuals? Secondly, what percentage of are other extremist ideologies? For domestic violence extremists, homegrown violence extremists, and international extremists, how many total FBI investigations are ongoing? And of that figure, one, how many are motivated by jihadist ideology? How many are motivated by white supremacy ideology? And how many are motivated by left-wing anarchist ideologies? We need data, and I hope you see our need for this data. So can you answer those now, or do you want to get back in writing?
Well, I will certainly get back to them. I'm aware that that we've gotten a letter that goes through in quite detail a number of specific data requests, and we're working on that response as we speak. There are probably some things I could say sitting here right now. As I said to the chairman, although I don't have the percentage for you, the attackers on January 6th included a number, and the number keeps growing as we build out our investigations of what we would call militia violent extremism. And we have had some already arrested who we would put in the category of racially motivated violent extremism, white as well. Those would be the categories so far that we're seeing as far as January 6th. Now, looking back, bigger picture, because I think the rest of your question goes more to our caseload overall, I can say a number of things on that. In terms of domestic violent extremism, domestic terrorism, that number is now has grown steadily on my watch. So we've increased the number of domestic terrorism investigations from around 1,000 or so when I got here to up to about 1,400 at the end of last year to about 2,000 now. That's domestic terrorism overall. When it comes to racially motivated violent extremism, that number, again, number of investigations and number of arrests has grown significantly on my watch. And the number of arrests, for example, of racially motivated violent extremists who are what you would categorize as white supremacists, last year was almost triple the number it was in my first year as director. And when it comes to anarchist violent extremists, which is another category that you asked about, that number has also grown over the course of my tenure. Last year, I think we had more arrests of anarchist violent extremists than in the prior 3 years combined.
Do you stand by your previous testimony that white supremacist extremism is the dominant, most persistent source of domestic terrorism threats we face today?
I would certainly say, as I think I've said consistently in the past, that racially motivated violent extremism, specifically of the sort that advocates for the superiority of the white race, is a persistent, evolving threat. It's the biggest chunk of our racially motivated violent extremism cases, for sure. And racially motivated violent extremism is the biggest chunk of our domestic terrorism portfolio, if you will, overall. I will also say that the same group of people we're talking about have been responsible for the most lethal attacks over the last, say, decade.
And I understand from your testimony previously that you did not see Antifa or left-wing groups playing a significant role in the January 6th insurrection.
Certainly, while we're equal opportunity in looking for violent extremism of any ideology, we have not to date seen any evidence of anarchist violent extremists or people subscribing to Antifa in connection with the 6th. That doesn't mean we're not looking, and we'll continue to look, but at the moment, we have not seen that.
Well, certainly, I have other questions for the record, but you've testified before about a fusion cell development to address both hate crimes and domestic terrorism. Has that been helpful?
It has. So what you're referring to is something that I put in place, I guess, about 18 months, maybe 2 years ago. I created a domestic terrorism hate crimes fusion cell, which brought together, because a lot of these crimes could fit either into a domestic terrorism bucket or a hate crimes bucket. And what I was worried about was making sure that within the FBI we didn't have a left-hand, right-hand problem. And so we brought together people focusing on both into a single fusion cell with the goal of trying to be proactive against some of the threats that are coming. And one example that I'll cite that we're particularly pleased with, which I think is an indication of the success the cell is having, we were able to get in front of and prevent an attempted, I think, explosives attack on a synagogue in Colorado. That, I think, is largely a credit to the fusion cell, which was able to kind of help us figure out how to get in front of those kinds of attacks.
Back to January the 6th, is it fair to say, as director of the FBI, you were not informed of the raw intelligence coming from the Norfolk office? Is that correct?
Not before January 6th.
Okay. So this was an internet posting that somebody captured?
My understanding is that this was information posted online under a moniker or a pseudonym. It was unvetted, uncorroborated information, but it was, and it was somewhat aspirational in nature, but it was concerning. It was concerning and was specific enough that our folks in Norfolk thought the need to get it out, even if we hadn't had a chance to corroborate or vet it.
Okay. Looking back, what would you have done differently with this information? Because this is a hard one. You get something on the internet that's concerning. You don't know if it's true or not. You capture it. What are the lessons learned in terms of how we could have acted better on that information?
I think the truthful answer is we're still looking at that. You know, this was, yeah. You know, I look at intelligence both collection, analysis, dissemination. We need to get better at collecting, obviously, but the key part here was we often don't have the luxury of time to analyze this information before it gets disseminated. And in this instance, our folks in Norfolk and Washington Field made the judgment that, and I think it was a reasonable judgment, to get the information, like I said, in three different ways to their partners, even though they didn't know whether it was going to turn out to be accurate.
Is the Proud Boys, are they a domestic terrorist group?
I don't think we have treated the Proud Boys itself as a domestic terrorism group, but we certainly have individuals.
What does it take to make the list?
Well, there is, as you may know, Senator, under federal law, under U.S. law, there is no list of domestic terrorism organizations the same way there is for foreign terrorist organizations.
Well, let's think about that in the next 47 seconds. Oath Keepers, are they a domestic terrorist organization?
We again, as with Proud Boys, we have individuals who associate themselves with that group.
Antifa,
who are
domestic terrorists. Domestic terrorist organization? Same thing, same answer?
Same answer.
So why don't we think about how to gather better information and expose some of these groups? If they were on a list, would it make it easier for you?
I think the issue of whether or not to designate or have a formal mechanism for designating domestic terror groups in the same way we do with, say, Al-Qaeda or ISIS, I think there's reasonable debate about whether or not it would really advance the
needle. Is the KKK a domestic terrorist group?
Well, there is no legal designation for domestic terrorism.
My point is, I don't know if we should have one or not, but I think it's time to think about it.
Thank you, Senator Graham. Senator Feinstein.
Thanks very much, Mr. Chairman, and welcome. Last November, the Associated Press reported that hate crimes rose to the highest level in more than a decade. The AP also reported that the United States recorded the most hate-related killings since the FBI began collecting data in the 1980s. Despite this finding, only about 14% of the agencies in the FBI hate crimes report indicated that hate crimes occurred in their jurisdictions. So here's the questions. What actions are you taking to make it easier for local agencies to collect and report this data to the FBI?
So I appreciate the question. As your question references, we do know that there is a phenomenon that I think is fairly widely accepted of underreporting of hate crimes. And so even though the number of hate crimes reported continues to grow, we don't know whether that means the number of hate crimes is growing or whether the number of reports of it is now starting to grow. We are trying to do a lot, and we do hundreds of these outreach, training, et cetera, of state and local law enforcement to help them understand better how to identify and report hate crimes. We also have a manual that we put out that helps explain better how to identify that. Of course, a lot of times the offenses that they're looking at under state and local laws don't necessarily come with a neat label that says this is a hate crime on it, and so that's part of the challenge. But we're working with them to try to improve awareness so that we can get better reporting on the subject.
Why is the threat of white supremacist terrorism so prevalent in this country?
I think that's a... some of that is a sociological question that I'm not sure that I'm really the right person to address. Certainly, as you say, it has been the biggest chunk of our racially motivated violent extremism cases, and itself the biggest chunk of our domestic terrorism caseload overall, and the most lethality over the last decade has been from these same extremists. The things that drive these people, I think, range. One of the things that we struggle with in particular is that more and more the ideologies, if you will, that are motivating some of these violent extremists are less and less coherent, less and less linear, less and less easy to kind of pin down. In some cases, it seems like people coming up with their own sort of customized belief systems, a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and they put it together, maybe combined with some personal grievance of something that's happened in their lives, and that drives them. And so trying to get your arms around that is a real challenge.
As early as December 29th, the FBI warned about the potential for armed demonstrators targeting legislatures. The former chief of Capitol Police, as well as the House and Senate sergeants of arms, have testified that they did not see the FBI's warning on the eve of January 6 about potential violence in the Capitol. When did you first receive intelligence about the possibility of an attack on the Capitol on January 6, and what happened to the process that people weren't seeing the warnings?
Well, Senator, I think the intelligence or the information that you're asking about is the much-discussed Norfolk SIR, or Situational Information Report. I didn't see that report, which was raw, unverified intelligence, until some number of days after the 6th. But, again, that raw, unverified information was passed within, I think, 40 minutes to an hour to our partners, including the Capitol Police, including Metro PD, in not one, not two, but three different ways, one email, one verbal, and one through the law enforcement portal. As to why the information didn't flow to all the people within the various departments that they would prefer, I don't have a good answer for that. I will tell you the Capitol Police and Metro PD are terrific partners to the FBI, especially our Washington field office. I'm grateful for their partnership and have nothing but admiration for the hard work and courage and professionalism of the men and women who work in both of those agencies.
Do you think the current laws are adequate to deal with this threat? It strikes me as these are a lot of different tools that are available but don't really get to the whole heart of domestic terrorism.
Well, I guess I'd say a couple things in response to that. It's of course a very good question. I think number one, our folks, which is one of the things I love about the men and women of the FBI, have proven time and again that they will work with the tools they have, and they are resourceful and entrepreneurial, and we've had remarkably good success at disrupting attacks using the tools that we have. And sometimes those tools and some of the offenses that you listed off have the virtue of being quite simple and straightforward to prove, and so sometimes that's actually a blessing. But certainly, I think you would be hard-pressed to find any FBI director that wouldn't welcome more tools in the toolbox.
Well, getting back to this narrative about who was involved on January the 6th, there was a helpful report from the George Washington University Program on Extremism that looked at about 257 federal defendants as a result of the events of January the 6th. They noted that 142 of those 257 defendants, they referred to as inspired believers. They said they concluded they were neither participants in any violent extremist group, nor connected with any individual who stormed the Capitol. Again, I guess bears out your conclusion, your statement that this is not a monolithic group again.
So I think you've touched on two very important points there. One is both with domestic violent extremists and, frankly, with what we call the homegrown violent extremists, which are the jihadist-inspired, the difference between inspired terrorist attacks and over here and domestic and sort of directed or facilitated, you know, in a more structured, formal way is something that I think a lot of Americans struggle with understanding. And more the threat that we face as a country is what I would call the inspired attacks. They don't have formal membership in an organization. They don't have clear command and control direction in the way that, say, an Al-Qaeda sleeper cell might have. And that's that much more challenging to pursue, A, because there are fewer dots to connect, you know, the old expression about dots to connect.
Right.
B, less time in which to connect whatever dots there are. And then you add into it, C, the sort of First Amendment dimensions of people's inspirations and ideology. And then the last point I would make is that we have these, as I said before, increasingly blended ideologies. So, for example, in Senator Klobuchar's state in Minnesota, we had two individuals who were identified themselves as so-called Boogaloo Boys, which people tend to put kind of in one bucket. And yet what they ultimately were charged with was trying to provide material support, as in weapons, to Hamas. And these are not things that neatly fit together in anybody's worldview. So it just illustrates one example, but it illustrates the challenge that we're dealing with.
It's the FBI's responsibility to deal with counterintelligence investigations, correct?
Yes.
And these include things like active measures that we saw used, for example, in 2016. For example, advertising on Facebook, two competing groups to show up at the same time and hoping that conflict and maybe even violence would break out. Is it true that our foreign adversaries used the events of January the 6th as a field day in terms of their attempt to establish false personas, fabricate stories on social media platforms with an intent to discredit the United States and its institutions?
Certainly we have seen, and I'll keep it at an unclassified level in this setting, but foreign adversaries, a number of them, leveraging the events of January 6th to amplify their own narratives, to try to push out propaganda, misinformation, to try to, in their view, accelerate what they think of as the United States' decline.
We've run this rigmarole with the interagency process in which we don't get answers. Some of these go back to 2017, by the way. That's years of not getting our questions answered. And then, when it's a question that's suddenly of interest to one party and to President Trump, there seems to be a little side road that gets built around the traffic jam. And stuff just flies right through. So please don't tell me about interagency process when I've been sitting in this committee watching FBI information get straight to this committee without interagency process. What are we going to do about this? Is this a problem?
So, Senator, let me say first, as I said, that I absolutely agree with you that Congress needs answers to its questions. I am frustrated as well at the process. I have added more staff, and my understanding is that when it comes to correspondence, for example, which just doesn't require the same interagency process, that we have significantly reduced the backlog and the turnaround time. But there's no question in my mind.
We had
no question in my mind.
8 letters go unanswered, the oldest one dated March of 2017. So if you think your process is working, we're not seeing it on our end.
Well, I will commit to you that I will do what I can to improve the process. I am frustrated as you are, and we need to get better.
Are you geolocating people through the FBI based on where they were on January 6th?
I think there may be some instances in which geolocation has been an investigative tool, but I can't speak to any specifics.
I'm just trying to understand how you're getting it. So is the FBI accessing cell phone tower metadata from telecommunications companies? Is that where it's coming from?
Again, without knowing the specifics, without being able to drill into the specifics, it's hard for me to answer your question.
Now, Inspector General Horowitz issued a report in 2019 regarding Crossfire Hurricane, and through a subsequent memorandum dealing with Woods file issues that really help prove my point. At the time, in response to those concerns, you issued statements suggesting that you would take concrete actions to make sure that these things were changed. Could you tell me what some of those actions are? Have you taken the actions you referred to in response to Horowitz's report and his subsequent memo on the Woods file issues?
Yes, Senator, I welcome the question. So first off, as you may know, we accepted all of the findings and recommendations in the Inspector General's report. I ordered, at the time, over 40 corrective actions to go above and beyond the recommendations of the Inspector General's report, and those have been implemented. Those include everything from strengthening our procedures to ensure accuracy and completeness, to make sure the court gets all the information it's supposed to, changes in our protocols for CHSs, confidential human sources, training changes. I created a new Office of Internal Audit that's specifically focused on FISA auditing. There's a whole number of things I'd be happy to walk through, but I recognize that our time is limited, so you tell me how much.
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
And I appreciate anything that you've done within the agency to do that. I hope you can understand my concern, which is that we've been told over and over again we already have strong procedures in place internally. Those strong procedures apparently haven't, over the last 10 years, proven enough. So my view is that in addition to anything that you may be doing that may well be helpful, and I appreciate anything that you're doing that's helpful, we probably ought to have some statutory restrictions as well, so that it's not the FBI and the FBI alone acting solely upon the FBI's internal guidance documents, from which the FBI could, of course, choose to depart at any moment. I'd love to see reforms in this area, and in particular to protect the civil liberties of the American people. I think we need some reforms to our domestic surveillance tools, including things like FISA, that would apply to strengthening the amicus provisions of the FISA court, requiring the FBI to disclose all material exculpatory evidence that's presented to the FISA court. No less important here than in an Article III court sitting in its capacity of adjudicating criminal cases. In fact, if anything, it's more important here, because in the FISA context, it's not public. Increasing the standard for warrants under Section 215 to require a probable cause and requiring a probable cause warrant to obtain internet search history, internet browsing history, and geolocation information. Are those reforms that you'd be willing to support?
Well, Senator, I'd be happy to work with you to provide sort of operational assessment of the impact of different legislative ideas. Certainly, we view our responsibility as not just to protect the American people, but also to uphold the Constitution. And we say that every day in the FBI. Certainly, I would want to make sure that any legislative changes to FISA didn't have unintended, very damaging impact on everything from our sharing of information with our foreign partners, our intelligence community partners, that we didn't elevate the standard in FISA above the level of what we could get, for example, in an ordinary criminal case, things like that. But we'd be happy to engage with you on the subject.
Our witnesses all agreed that there is now clear evidence that supports the conclusion that this insurrection was planned and a coordinated attack on the Capitol, that white supremacists and extremist groups were involved, and that what happened would have been much more dangerous if not for the brave actions of law enforcement. Would you agree with that?
Certainly there were aspects of it that were planned and coordinated, but yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was, I just noted that just today, reporting in the Washington Post, that on Monday, a complaint was filed against a member of the Proud Boys in Washington State, where federal prosecutors alleged that, in fact, there were plans made for many different entries into the Capitol. Is that correct?
Yes. There have been a growing number of charges as we continue to build out the investigation. Either individuals who are now starting to get arrested that involving charges that involve more things like planning and coordination, or in some instances, individuals who were charged with more simple offenses, but now we're superseding as we build out more of an understanding of what people were involved in. And then there were clearly some individuals involved, which I would consider the most dangerous, most serious cases among the group, who did have plans and intentions and some level of coordination.
And we know that the New York Police Department sent intelligence reports to them, to the Capitol Police, that's on them, and the FBI's Washington field office in late December indicating there'd be violence on January 6th. Any comments on that?
So, well, I'm not familiar with the specific NYPD product you're referring to. I will tell you that we, the FBI, over the course of 2020, put out a number of intelligence products specifically warning about domestic violent extremism, including specifically warning about it in connection with the election, including specifically warning about that threat in relation to the election, continuing past Election Day itself and up through the inauguration, and including a product that I think we put out with DHS in December of 2020. So we have trying to push out information. I am reluctant to armchair quarterback anyone else in their jobs. I can tell you we at the FBI are determined to do our part to make sure that what happened on January 6th doesn't happen again. We find it personally infuriating anytime we're not able, as I said, to bat 1,000, and we're going to keep working to get better.
You know, often in an investigation, law enforcement follows the money. Is there evidence at this point of coordinated funding prior to January 6th, providing military equipment, providing communications equipment, or the like?
Certainly, that's a topic that we're looking at. I don't know that there's anything I can say right now in terms of funding or coordinated funding.
There's been considerable discussion at this hearing also about the Norfolk report. At the time, how credible and reliable did the FBI consider the Norfolk report as an actionable piece of intelligence?
Senator, my understanding is that our folks at the time viewed it as raw, unverified, and therefore of unknown reliability information. But because of the level of detail that was in it, and some of this is art, not science, unfortunately, in the world of intelligence, the judgment was that given the press of time, given the specificity in it, even though it sounded somewhat aspirational in nature and was unverified, the smartest thing to do, the most prudent thing to do, was just to push it to the people who needed to get it. And as I said, that happened three different ways.
You had a conversation with Senator Grassley about the death of Officer Sicknick, and there obviously is considerable interest and concern in the Senate and across the country as to the circumstances of Officer Sicknick's death. There have been conflicting reports about the circumstances of his death. You told Senator Grassley the FBI at this point is not in a position to confirm a cause of death. Is there any information that the FBI can share with the American people about what we know of the circumstances surrounding his tragic death?
Although I'm certainly understand and appreciate the keen interest in it for all the reasons we've discussed, at the moment, other than to say the Capitol Police has, of course, categorized it, I think, appropriately as a line of duty death, there's nothing really that I can share right now. Certainly, I understand why it's very much top of mind for people, and I think it speaks well of the members of Congress that they're so interested in somebody who's lost his life protecting all of you. So as soon as we're in a position, when the investigation has gotten to a stage where we can share information, we want to be able to do that.
Has there so far been any evidence that the January 6th riot here, the insurrection, was organized by people simply posing as supporters of President Trump's?
We have not seen any evidence of that, certainly at this
point. Is there any evidence at all that it was organized or planned or carried out by groups like Antifa or Black Lives Matter?
We have not seen any evidence to that effect thus far in the investigation.
And is there any doubt that the people who stormed the Capitol included white supremacists and other far-right extremist organizations?
There's no doubt that it included individuals that we would call militia violent extremists, and then in some instances, individuals that were racially motivated violent extremists who advocate for, you know, the superiority of the white race. But the militia violent extremists is probably at the moment trending the biggest bucket, if you will.
Well, you face challenges. We as a nation face challenges with extremists of all stripes, types, backgrounds, motivations. As the new chair of the Subcommittee on Privacy and Technology and Law, I'm concerned about how extremists have used social media platforms to organize and incite violence, and in some ways about how social media platforms work to accentuate or accelerate those who have extreme views and to potentially radicalize those who don't hold those views. I led a letter with 14 colleagues last November to Facebook raising concerns about the adequacy of their enforcement of their own policies against violence and incitement. Can you speak to the extent to which the January 6th attack on the Capitol was organized through social media platforms?
So certainly social media on January 6th, as for the domestic violent extremist threat more broadly, has become a major factor, a catalyst, if you will. The increased speed, dissemination, efficiency, accessibility that it provides, it facilitates a greater interconnected nature in a more decentralized way. And so we, you know, I sometimes say terrorism today, and we saw it on the 6th, moves at the speed of social media. And we try to work with social media companies to get them to more aggressively use the tools that they have to police their own platforms under terms of service, et cetera, and in particular to cooperate with us so that we can bring justice for those who hijack these companies' platforms to engage in some of the conduct we're talking about. And that's where you heard a little bit about the encryption issue come up. That's an important part of this. We are moving in a direction. We saw it on the 6th, and we're seeing it more and more every day in this country, where violent extremists, just like other bad actors, are taking advantage of encrypted platforms to evade law enforcement. And that social media companies and the technology companies are moving more and more in a direction where if we don't come up collectively with some kind of solution, it's not going to matter how bulletproof the legal process is or how horrific the crime is or how heartbreaking the victims are, we will not be able to get access to the content and the evidence that we need to protect the American people. And then I think we will all rue the day at front.
Thank you. Last, Senator Feinstein asked you a series of questions about the record number of NICS denials last year. This is when someone goes in, tries to buy a gun, gets run through the background check system and is denied. They're a person prohibited, often because they're a convicted felon. I'm soon going to be introducing a bill with a colleague on this committee that would simply require that when there is an attempt to buy that is denied because someone is a person prohibited, that notification be given to state law enforcement. That is the law in some states. It is not the law in a majority of states. Does that seem to you something that would be a good additional tool in the toolkit to allow state and local law enforcement to act on the tip that someone who is a person prohibited has just lied and tried to procure a weapon?
Certainly, I think the lied and tried information is often a valuable tool from an investigative perspective in preventing more serious conduct. And we'd be happy to meet with you or engage with you to provide a little bit better sense of how all this works from an operational perspective. I know that the key consumer of the information here, as your question alludes, are state and local law enforcement. So I would want to make sure that we do it in a way where we work with them as to what they would find most useful. Certainly, as I said in response to Senator Feinstein, the volume of NICS checks overall, and with it the volume as a small subset of denials, has exploded over the course of the last year. And so I am mindful of the resource burden that it puts on everybody in the law enforcement system, but be happy to talk with you more about it.
Thanks. I look forward to working with you on that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We've talked a good bit about the intelligence failures around January 6th, but some of it is how did we sort signal from noise, and some of it is the handoff from the FBI and other entities to the Capitol Police. As you do an after action, how much of the problem is the challenge of navigating a social media world where any drunk guy in a bar now has amplification that he can be heard around the world, and lots of it is just drunk guy in a bar ranting, and some of it is more particular threats because people can find communities of kind of warped belief with other people if they're planning something wicked on social media. How much of it is the filtering through social media for you to make sense of it, and how much of the January 6th failure was the handoff from the FBI to Capitol Police?
Well, Senator, as I said, when it comes to the handoff, a lot of the attention has really been about this Norfolk SIR, which I think I've talked about it at some length, where we provided the information to our partners in three different ways. And as it was, the information was raw, uncorroborated information at the time, certainly. I think the other part of your question, the filter, the social media piece of it, is a huge issue. And it's something that we and everybody in law enforcement struggles with right now. You use the drunk guy example. I guess that sometimes I refer to it. Used to be that some angry, demented guy living in mom's basement, not that there's anything wrong with that, in one part of the country is now able to communicate with the similarly angry guy in grandma's attic in another part of the country, and they get each other spun up now. And how to separate who's being aspirational versus who's being intentional. It won't shock you to learn, and hopefully not other members of the committee, that the amount of angry, hateful, unspeakable, combative, violent even rhetoric on social media exceeds what anybody in their worst imagination is out there. And so trying to figure out who's just saying, you know what we ought to do is X, or everybody ought to do X, versus the person who's doing that and actually getting traction and then getting followers. And, of course, that's assuming they're not communicating through encrypted channels about all that stuff, is one of the hardest things there is to do in today's world with the nature of the violent extremism threat we face. Social media companies play a huge role in helping us with that. But you often hear us say, if you see something, say something. To me, the refinement here would be if Americans see something on social media that seems to have crossed that line, they need to say something, because that's going to be our best source of information to prevent this.
So it's helpful. I've heard from Nebraska law enforcement before. At one level, they don't really know what to do with if you see something, say something, because it's not clear exactly where they hand that information. So let's talk a little bit more about the handoff between state and local law enforcement, as Senator Coons was, and the Bureau, but also between technology platform, content moderation, and the Bureau. But first, just inside the Bureau, give us comfort that we're getting a lot better at this, because I don't think we're giving you enough resources to get the right kind of new human capital you're going to need. But I'd love to be wrong. So go from 3 years ago to a year ago to today, and a day to a year from now. How are we getting better at filtering signal from noise? And what kind of new human capital are you hiring that should give us confidence that we're going to get better in this world that is exploding with lots of online rant?
Well, certainly there's a number of things we're trying to do to get better, and I think we are making progress, but all of it, as you referenced, requires resources. So there's a data analytics piece, because the volume is so significant that we need to get better at being able to analyze the data that we have, to do it in a timely way, to separate the wheat from the chaff. And that requires both tools, analytical tools, and we've had requests for those in the budgets the last couple of years, but also people, data analysts, who can devote their time to that, who have the experience. So that's part of it. I think a second part of it is, as I think I referenced in response to an earlier question, all of these investigations that we do, all these arrests we make, are important not just from a disruption perspective, but putting my intelligence hat on,
yep,
they allow us to learn more about where people communicate, how they communicate, what the magic words are, all that kind of stuff. So we get better at anticipating from that reason. But make no mistake, we've got a long way to go. This is an incredibly hard problem. I know from communicating with my foreign counterparts, especially the Five Eyes, that they're struggling with it too. As to your point about people knowing where to go, you know, I will tell you that our tip line, our public access tip line, both the email tips and the phone tips, have exploded in volume, and we're doing things to kind of get that information out to state and local law enforcement much more quickly. And certainly the social media companies, some of them have gotten better at providing us more real-time information when they see something, because they have a lot of resources to devote to this problem in terms of policing their own platforms. So the more we can incentivize them to do that, that's a big part of this too.
I would like to ask you whether the threat posed by QAnon, and as you well know, adherents of QAnon were among the rioters very prominently who stormed the Capitol, whether the continuing threat is worsened when prominent elected officials, including members of Congress, endorse the QAnon theory?
Well, certainly we are concerned about the QAnon phenomenon, which we view as a sort of loose sort of set of conspiracy theories, and we've certainly seen domestic violent extremists of the sort that you're describing, who cite that as part of their motivation. So that's something that we do.
But I apologize for interrupting. As you know, my time is limited. When members of Congress, as has happened, endorse the QAnon theory, doesn't it worsen the threat of violence?
Well, again, our focus is on the violence and on the plans to commit violence, on the threats to commit violence. It's less on the rhetoric and the ideology. Obviously, the folks who engage in this kind of violence draw inspiration from a variety of sources, and we're concerned about any source that stimulates or motivates violent extremism.
And knowing how much information there was out there on social media, in other forums, about these thugs and rioters coming to Washington, organized groups, three percenters, Proud Boys, and others, are wondering, why didn't the FBI sound the alarm? I know there was a communication through that threat assessment. I know you've talked about the agencies that were hearing that assessment. But here we have the United States Capitol, where a key function of democracy, enabling the peaceful transition of power, was taking place, and a threat of violence and even death to them. Why didn't you go to the Gang of Eight? Why didn't you sound the alarm in some more visible and ringing way?
Well, Senator, I guess a couple things. One, over the course of 2020, we repeatedly put out intelligence products on this very issue, domestic violent extremism specifically tied to the election, domestic violent extremism specifically tied to the election and continuing beyond the election up through the inauguration,
and specifically in December of 2020. In addition to that, in connection with the one piece of raw intelligence that's been discussed so much here today, we did pass that on to the people in the best position to take action on the threat, not one, not two, but three different ways. Now, more broadly, in terms of what's out in social media, as a number of the questions here today have elicited, I think it highlights, and your question highlights, one of the most challenging jobs for law enforcement in today's world with social media. There is so much chatter, often unattributed to somebody in a neatly identifiable way, where people are saying unbelievably horrific, angry, combative things, using language about beheading and shooting and explosives and all kinds of things like that, and separating out which ones are getting traction, which ones reflect intention as opposed to aspiration, is something that we spend an enormous amount of time trying to do. Sometimes we don't have the luxury of time and the ability to make those judgments. I can assure you that, as I said, I think to Senator Klobuchar, my standard is we're trying to bat 1,000. We want to thwart every attack. And anytime there's an attack that's not thwarted, we and our partners want to make sure that we figure out how to do even better at preventing that. We're pleased that the inauguration, for example, went smoothly, notwithstanding threats and chatter that we were seeing, not just here in the National Capital Region, but against state capitals all across the country. And our focus was on engaging with all of our partners, our state and local partners. I did a conference call with like 1,000-plus police chiefs from around the country about the state capitals. That's the kind of thing we were doing to try to make sure that we're doing the grind, the hard work, to get in front of the threat, and we're going to keep working at it every single day.
Is the FBI, are you currently pressuring any of these platforms, these social media platforms or tech platforms, to include backdoors in their software that would help defeat end-to-end encryption?
Are we pressuring?
Are you encouraging?
Oh,
are you pushing for? Is it, well, your desire to get such access?
We are not trying to get backdoors. That is, I think, a criticism that gets leveled our way by people who don't understand our position often. So I appreciate the opportunity to address it here. We are concerned about end-to-end encryption, especially default end-to-end encryption in connection with a lot of these platforms. And we are concerned that if these companies continue to move in the trajectory that they're moving in, we are going to find ourselves in a situation where no matter how bulletproof or ironclad the legal authority, no matter how compelling the facts and circumstances, no matter how horrific the crime or heartbreaking the victim, we will not be able to get access to the content that we need to keep people safe. What we have been suggesting, and the cryptologists and cryptographers that I talk to say this is doable, is for the companies themselves to build in a way to have legal access when confronted with a proper legal authority so that they can get access to the information and provide it in response to a warrant or a court order. We're not going to have a key. We're not asking for a back door. That's a myth, an urban legend that has been directed our way. But this is a subject that I think the American people need to understand, because decisions that affect the life and blood of Americans all over this country, which normally are made by our elected representatives, are in effect getting made in corporate offices in big technology companies. And different people can come down in different places on that balancing, but I would submit that's a balancing that should be made up here and not by one company based on its business model. And in the context, for example, of child exploitation, we get, and to Facebook's great credit, we get millions of tips on child exploitation through NCMEC every year that help us prevent and rescue kids, hundreds of kids every year. If they move forward in the direction they're moving in, which is the direction, by the way, that Apple already went, we're going to be in a position where those tips, those leads, that content, that information will drop into the abyss. So the tips will be gone. The victims, all those kids will still be out there. The pedophiles that are exploiting them, they'll still be out there. The only thing that'll be different is that neither the company nor we in law enforcement will know who they are, where they are, or what they're doing. And I don't think that's a situation that we want to find ourselves in. So we would welcome the opportunity to work with the companies, perhaps encouraged or incentivized through Congress, to get to a situation where we can balance strong cybersecurity, absolutely, it's a key part of our mission as well at the FBI, along with strong flesh and blood security, especially for America's children.
You've testified that so far there is no evidence of fake Trump supporters committing or provoking violence during the January 6th riot at the Capitol. That's part of the misinformation that got out. Were you aware of these false claims?
Well, certainly along the way, we've seen a whole variety of claims from a variety of people about the investigation into the January 6th attack, just like with a lot of other high-profile attacks. Whether I can recall exactly when the first time I've heard that specific claim, I don't know for sure.
You also testified, and you were asked some questions about the role of social media by these extremist groups. And you said that terrorism moves at the speed of social media. Senators Warner, Klobuchar, and I recently introduced the Safe Tech Act, which would pull back Section 230 immunity from tech companies for things like civil rights violations and wrongful death suits. Do you think that exposing these companies to civil liability would force them basically to take extremist content off of their platforms, or to take these kinds of content more seriously and do something about them?
Well, Senator, I want to be careful not to get out ahead of the rest of the administration and weighing in on specific pieces of legislation. But having said that, I think there are a few things I could say. You know, one is, while the immunity under Section 230 has obviously helped the evolution of the social media industry, it's also allowed it to avoid a lot of the burdens and risks that other brick-and-mortar companies have had to face. And it means that important decisions that affect many aspects of society that would normally be made by the people's elected representatives are now being made in corporate offices in the industry. And so, while I can't comment on specific legislation, I certainly can tell you that I see the value, maybe is the best way of putting it, of incentivizing online platforms to address both illicit content on their platforms and to assist law enforcement in bringing to justice criminals who use those platforms to victimize Americans.
So what can we all do to deal with the problem of lone wolf extremists?
So I appreciate the question. We do consider that the lone actor. I've sort of stopped using the term wolf because I feel like it gives them too much credit. But the lone actors, whether they're homegrown violent extremists or domestic violent extremists, is a real threat because because it's so pervasive, but B, because unlike somebody who's working as part of a large group, somebody acting alone has fewer people they're in contact with, which means fewer dots to connect, et cetera. It makes it that much harder for us to get in front of. What we desperately need is more and more situations where the members of the public who know that person, who see the transformation, who see things starting to change in a way that they know is different and has become much darker and more dangerous, those people to speak up, to contact law enforcement, whoever they trust in law enforcement, to alert people to the threat. And the good news, if there's any good news in this, is that we are seeing that happen more and more in this country. We've had lots of people, as heartbreaking as it must be, turn in family members when they see this transformation, because they know that having us or our partners intercede may not only prevent that person from committing an attack against an innocent American, but also may in some instances result in that person being off-ramped to get help, as opposed to potentially being killed by law enforcement or incarcerated or something else. So we need the people. We always say, if you see something, say something, and most people picture the abandoned backpack in a Greyhound bus terminal. Obviously, we want people to see something and say something there. But we also need people, if they see something about somebody, to say something. And the more of that we can have, and the more members of Congress as key voices in their communities, in your home states, can encourage people to do that, that's one of the key weapons we have as a country to use your phrase, a whole of society defense against this threat.
You say that the FBI assesses homegrown violent extremists as the greatest, most immediate international threat to the homeland. These extremists are U.S.-based individuals located in and radicalized primarily in the U.S. who are not receiving individualized direction from global jihad-inspired foreign terrorist organizations, but are inspired largely by ISIS and al-Qaeda to commit violence. So what you're saying there, Director Ray, if I understand it correctly, is that dangerous though the threat is from other kinds of extremists like racial supremacist groups or anarchist groups, the most dangerous threat we have in the country from extremism remains jihadist. Is that correct?
Well, I think the key word there was international. I don't have the written statement for the record in front of me, but what I would say is what we view as the most dangerous threat to Americans today is largely lone actors, some cases small cells, if you will, largely radicalized online, already here in the United States, attacking soft targets using crude, readily accessible weapons, motivated either by jihadist inspirations or by a variety of domestic inspirations. So we have the HVEs, the homegrown violent extremists, which are the jihadist-inspired, and we have the DVEs, the domestic violent extremists, who are inspired by domestic sources. That bucket, which have a lot in common with each other, is the greatest threat, the greatest terrorism threat we face as a country.
My first question is how diverse is the FBI's workforce now in terms of gender, religious, and racial diversity?
So, Senator, this is a topic that, as you may recall from our prior visit, is very important to me personally and something I've tried to make as a priority. We're addressing it in a variety of ways, but in terms of results, there is, I guess I would characterize it as cautiously optimistic. So on the racial diversity front, our special agent class has been more diverse with each year over the past few years. In each case, more certainly than the diversity percentage of the workforce that exists. And this year, which I think is a bright spot, the racial diversity of our applicant pool is much higher than it was in years past. On gender, much the same. The diversity of applications is up significantly. The diversity, gender diversity of our Quantico classes is up. I've set aggressive targets for our field offices, and those targets are for the most part being exceeded. So we're doing a number of things to try to address the issue. We have what we call diversity agent recruitment events, which were easier to do pre-COVID, but that, you know, that a lot of times I would go to in different parts of the country myself and speak at. We have a very encouraging project we've started with 300 Entertainment that's focused on historically black colleges and universities and trying to improve our recruiting pipeline there.
Maybe just ask you, could you share that data with the committee of the progress that you're making?
Sure. I think there's definitely information we could provide separately.
And then your leadership team, can you provide the diversity of the leadership team that you have around you?
Sure. I will say yes is the answer. But I will say that on that front, I've recently appointed to, you know, we have, I'm not sure how much you may remember about our structure, but we have at the very top of the FBI six EADs, executive assistant directors, each one of is over a branch that has multiple divisions. So just over the last couple of months, as people retire, I've replaced one of the EADs with an Asian American woman who oversees our human resources branch, and one of the other of these six EADs with an African American male who oversees our intelligence branch, which includes not just our entire intelligence function, but our private sector engagement and our law enforcement partner engagement as well. I also appointed the first.
I want to honor the time here. I look forward to, I know you'll be available to discuss that more and get the information. In the minute or so I have left, I think a lot of the questioning has been very illustrative of a lot of the challenges we face, and I appreciate that from members of both sides of the dais here. I just wanted to drill into something. We've talked about the extremist groups that were at the Capitol. We talked about many others, but as I've seen interviews of folks, there were many people that were just saying, "I'm here because President Trump, now former President Trump, wanted us here." And it seemed that this lie that was told over and over again, that many people felt like their government had betrayed them, that the courts, and after court case, that Republican official after Republican official were all just dead wrong, really believed in the lie, and felt like they were left with no choice but to try to stop the peaceful transfer of power. And so I guess I just ask to begin with, is that Attorney General Barr said that he had, quote, not seen fraud on a scale that could have affected a different outcome in the election. Do you agree with Attorney General Barr's statement that there is absolutely no evidence of voter fraud that could have changed the outcome of the 2020 presidential election?
I agree with Attorney General Barr.
And to be crystal clear on this, as FBI director, these would be federal crimes, you're aware of no evidence of widespread voter fraud in the 2020 presidential election, correct?
We are not aware of any widespread evidence of voter fraud, much less that would have affected the outcome in the presidential election.
The Horowitz report. Can you tell me how many people you have referred for prosecution at the FBI as a result of the Horowitz report?
Well, for prosecution or for discipline?
For prosecution first. Just give me numbers because I don't want to abuse my time.
Well, the prosecution issue related to anything to do with the Horowitz report
is
in the hands
of
Inspector.
I get it. How many of you fired?
So most of the people involved in the Horowitz report are former employees. Of the ones who are current, every single one of them, even if mentioned only in passing, has been referred to our Office of Professional Responsibility, which is our disciplinary arm. Now, that piece, and this is important, that piece of it, because we're cooperating fully with Mr. Durham's investigation, at his request, we had slowed that process down to allow his criminal investigation to proceed. So at the moment, that process is still underway in order to make sure that we're being appropriately sensitive to the criminal investigation.
Some of the most striking revelations in the aftermath of the January 6th insurrection here in the Capitol were reports that some members of the Capitol Police were sympathetic to the insurrectionists, that they posed for photos, provided directions, and may have even expressed support for those attacking the very building they're sworn to protect. I understand that 6 Capitol Police officers have been suspended, and at least 29 others are under investigation for their alleged role in the attack. We've also learned that among those participating in the insurrection were numerous off-duty law enforcement officers from around the country. Rooting out white supremacists and right-wing extremists is a challenge that local law enforcement agencies and even the United States military is facing across the country. Director Ray, how is the FBI assisting law enforcement agencies across the country to root out white supremacy or other forms of extremism? And do you believe there's a concerted effort by right-wing extremists to infiltrate law enforcement agencies?
So I guess a few things I would say on this topic. Certainly it is true that in some instances, as we're continue to investigate the January 6th attack, there have been some instances of current or in particular former military or law enforcement who participated, and we want to pursue those cases just as aggressively as we would anybody else. We are also, though, which may go more to the heart of your question, when appropriate, referring individuals to the department that employs them for possible administrative or disciplinary action under their rules as appropriate. We work very closely with both our law enforcement partners and our military partners in their efforts to address any kind of violent extremism that may be in their midst. We view that as, in effect, a kind of insider threat, if you will. And they do too. And I want to be clear that in my experience, and I'm dealing with our law enforcement partners and our military partners every single day, the vast majority of the men and women in uniform, both in law enforcement and the military, are brave, selfless, professional, high-integrity individuals. But when there are bad apples in the midst, we work with our partners to try to get ahead of it.
But back on the rioters on January the 6th, can you give me a rough idea just of the crimes that many of them are being charged with or being pursued through investigations?
Well, we're using a variety of statutory weapons. There are certainly assault charges. There are a number of charges that are specific. By that, I mean assault against federal law enforcement, including the Capitol Police, the brave men and women of the Capitol Police that I think you rightly credited there. There's also various charges related to destruction of federal property, things along those lines. We are now starting to begin to see, as we've sort of taken care of the most immediate, easiest to prove, I hate to use a word like low-hanging fruit charges, yep, but now we're starting to get more of the more advanced charges, if you will. So, you know, we've had some conspiracy charges recently. Some of the people that are more involved with different forms of planning or coordination or preparation, and some of those charges are starting to happen, and I would expect to see that continue.
Incidentally, Mr. Chair, I want to associate myself with Senator Graham's comments earlier. I think your threats are going up, and we've got to match that with additional resources, so I look forward to the committee continuing that. Would you see any difference between the charges, the investigations that you're pursuing in the events on January 6th and charges that should be pursued against federal buildings and federal law enforcement officers being harmed in Seattle or Portland? Are there active investigations for either of those two events, and would they be treated any differently?
As I think said in response to an earlier question, we are equal opportunity. So by that I mean we don't care what ideology motivates you. If you're engaged in violence that violates federal law, we're coming for you. And that's just true for the events over the summer and some of the domestic terrorism that occurred there.
Are there active investigations related to those events?
Yes.
Thank you. You know, I feel like you mentioned in response to one of the members' questions about this just increasing, the volume's increasing. I've introduced in the last Congress, I intend to reintroduce a bill called Protect and Serve, which increases penalties for rioters for assaults on federal officers and more significant consequences. Do you think that those would be helpful tools for law enforcement?
Certainly.
And for prosecution?
Sorry, I didn't mean to
interrupt.
Go ahead. I think, while I'm not familiar with the specific bill, I want to enthusiastically support the idea of looking at everything we can do to protect the men and women of law enforcement. The threats, the violence against law enforcement in this country is one of the most tragic and sometimes least talked about challenges we face. This year alone, an officer is shot and killed in the line of duty at a rate of more than one a week. Mm-hmm. And when you think about what it takes for someone to be willing to sacrifice his or her life for a total stranger, and how unusual that is, just to begin with, and then you add on top of that somebody who's willing to do that, get up and do that every single day, day after day after day, and they never know when that day might be the day that they don't come home to their families. And so then you put that in the context of the way in which some violent opportunists or domestic terrorists hijack some of these protests, whether it's the ones over the summer or the ones on the 6th. And now you've got some of these same selfless individuals who are in many cases killed, but for everyone who's killed, there's someone who survived, thank goodness, but whose life and his family's life is forever altered. And I don't think we could ever and should ever take for granted those people, because they protect all of us.
I agree. I'm curious, with all the discussion of defund the police and systemic racism and all law enforcement agencies, some of the dialogue that's out there, have you seen any measurable decrease in the number of people who are trying to apply to come in to the FBI? I know I'm seeing it, and state troopers are telling me their applications for academies are down by over 70%. We see people accelerating their retirements. Do we have any potential threat out there, either within the FBI or for law enforcement in general, of having fewer people willing to get into this profession?
So certainly when it comes to state and local law enforcement, because I talk to many of the same chiefs and sheriffs you do, the recruiting challenge is a real concern, and it comes up all the time. That's something we need to be concerned about, and all of these trends that we're talking about will have, I think we run the risk of that, just making that trend worse. At the FBI, happily, because we can all use some good news from time to time, last year and the year before, we tripled the number of people, Americans across the country, applying to be special agents. So when I took the job, it was around 11,000 or so a year of people applying to be special agents. In 2019, it was about 36,000. And then last year, even with the pandemic, it was even higher than that. And that's the highest number of people applying to work at the FBI as special agents to put their lives on the line in about a decade. So we'd like to think our work is earning people who want to come work for us, and we're grateful for that. And hopefully we can do our part to try to encourage more people, because we can only take so many of them, to pursue law enforcement jobs in other agencies.
Well, that is good news. I just wish you all the best of luck in prosecuting every single person that you can that breached the Capitol, and every single person on the grounds who assaulted or threatened a police officer, if there's anything that we can do to help. And I will follow up with the department to get your perspective as to whether or not you think the Protect and Serve Act would be helpful. I think that it will be, but I'd like your professional judgment.
Thank you,
Mr. Senator. Chair. Appreciate it. Thanks, Senator. Senator Ossoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Director Ray, greetings from your home state of Georgia.
Thank you.
Thank you for your service. There's been a significant increase in shootings and violent crime nationwide over the last 18 months. There were at least 10 people shot in Atlanta, Georgia on Sunday. What does the FBI assess is driving this crime wave?
Well, certainly I am following the same trends you are with concern, not just in Atlanta, but in other cities around the country. I'm not sure there's any single factor that's driving it. I think it's a variety of things. We are seeing, some of it may be, the pandemic itself in its own way has had an impact. There are people who are maybe not at jobs or not in school or not otherwise available, and there's more potential for wrongdoing to occur. We've talked about some of the challenges with local police departments and some of the issues there in terms of their recruiting and staffing. A lot of them are understaffed in addition to the recruiting challenge, so that's a problem. So there are a variety of drivers that we think contribute to it, but the violent crime problem over the last year, in particular 2020, is something that is a great concern and that we are very warily keeping our eye on. It doesn't get the same kind of headlines as some of the other threats we've talked about today, but as your question, I think quite rightly implies, it's a subject that's near and dear to the hearts of all the people we know back home.
Yeah, well, with that many shootings in Atlanta on Sunday alone, this increase in violent crime is of grave concern to Georgians and people across the country. Will you work with this committee and my office to try to refine that assessment of the drivers of this violent crime wave?
We'd be pleased to do that. I commend you for your interest in the violent crime problem back in our home state.
Appreciate that, Director Ray. Next week will be the first anniversary of the shooting death of Breonna Taylor, a young woman who died when police officers in Louisville, Kentucky, entered her home with a battering ram, executing a no-knock search warrant connected to a narcotics investigation. Ms. Taylor was not the subject of that warrant. There's obviously been deepening and grave concern about equal justice, due process, the extent of brutality, harassment, discrimination faced by Black Americans in the criminal justice system growing over the last year, given incidents such as this one. Without commenting on the specifics of the late Ms. Taylor's case, is the FBI prioritizing investigations of cases involving color of law violations under 18 U.S.C. 242, and what resources have you instructed your field offices to commit to those investigations?
So as you say, I can't discuss the Taylor case specifically. We have an ongoing federal investigation there, but we are definitely trying to push forward on color of law cases. We do that through our civil rights division within our criminal investigative division. We are, in addition to the investigations we're pursuing, and we have quite a number around the country, we are also trying to contribute by doing different forms of training and outreach to state and local police departments so they understand better kind of where the lines are and where we fit into it. So that's a, you know, part of it as well. We're also trying to contribute to the situation by encouraging better reporting. You know, we've had a lot of conversations this morning in other contexts about statistics and reporting. And when it comes to use of force, we are trying to build out a use of force database that involves use of force by police departments, law enforcement agencies around the country. It's voluntary. We can't mandate all these local police departments to provide the information, but we are doing a lot to encourage them to submit their data. And my pitch to them has been, we're going to be talking about these issues no matter what, and we should all want the conversations to be based on the actual facts and the actual data as opposed to what some random person thinks the facts or data are. And so we're out now, reached one of the thresholds where we can start doing some of the reporting related to this effort. We need to get to a certain threshold statistically. I think it's like 80% or something of police departments before the data is considered statistically reliable. But so investigations, training and outreach, more complete statistical reporting on use of force.
Thank you, Director Ray. And I know the committee is considering legislation to make that data more available to you from local agencies. And will you provide to the committee and to my office an accounting of the FBI's investigations over the last 2 years, color of law violations, Title 18, USC 242?
Happy to see if we can provide you some more information on that.
Okay. Look forward to that.
Thanks.
Director Ray, is the recently revealed SolarWinds breach, a major cybersecurity breach, a failure, a counterintelligence failure by the U.S. government?
I don't know that I would describe it that way. Certainly the SolarWinds intrusion is something that reflects a trend that we've been calling out for some time, but it takes it to the next level. So for years, we've been warning of both China and Russia in efforts to inject malware and to undermine our trust in software that organizations all rely on. We've also called out the intrusions into managed service providers, which allow our adversaries to reach a far greater number of networks through sort of single entry points. The SolarWinds intrusion essentially takes this to the next level, purposely infecting a product that's widely used to manage networks. And so the scope, the scale, the somewhat indiscriminate nature of the intrusion is something we take very seriously with our partners.
But Director Ray, my time being limited, if I might, surely for malware to be embedded on sensitive U.S. networks at that scale and without detection for that duration must constitute a counterintelligence failure?
Well, I think it's a cybersecurity issue. Intelligence a little bit differently than just the kind of context you're talking about. But as I said, in some ways it's analogous to what I said about some of the earlier threats. You know, our goal is to try to bat 1,000. And anytime we don't bat 1,000, we're obviously looking hard to see at what we can do better to prevent that from happening again. When it comes to cyber intrusions in particular, though, we are long past the world where it's a question of if an organization is going to be the victim of cyber intrusion.
We're in the world of when. And the question is not whether somebody was subject of a cyber intrusion, but how fast does it get detected, how well does it get mitigated, et cetera. The scope, the scale, the range of attack methods, the number of adversaries involved in sophisticated cyber attacks dwarfs what it was when I was in law enforcement and national security before. And a huge amount of the information, for America in particular, is in the hands of the private sector. And so unlike on some of the other kinds of threats we've been talking about here this morning, the partnership between the intelligence community, other federal agencies, and the private sector is at the heart of the issue.
Thank you, Director Ray. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Ossoff. I'm glad you brought up SolarWinds because I think it's the first reference at this hearing. I'd like to do a follow-up before I recognize Senator Blackburn. So what do we do about it? We know that we don't have an extradition agreement with Russia, so even finding and naming the hackers doesn't lead to any punishment of them. What is our response as a deterrent to future cyber intrusion?
So, Mr. Chairman, I think discussing the response in any detail is probably something that would be better done in a classified setting. That by itself might give you a little bit of a hint. But what we have found, speaking more generally, what we have found over the last couple of years in the cyber arena in particular is that we are at our most effective when we have joint sequenced operations that essentially think of it as the having the whole be greater than the sum of the parts. So you mentioned a few of the things that can be done. Any one of those things by themselves ain't going to get the job done. But if you start putting some of those things together in a way where each amplifies the effect of the other, we have actually seen some pretty good results with some of our adversaries. So it's everything from not just the law enforcement piece, it's foreign partner participation, it's private sector hardening, it's treasury sanctions, it's a whole host of things. But when you put them together, sequenced, well, I would never suggest to you, and you would never believe me if I did suggest to you, that that's going to somehow just eliminate the problem. It does push the adversary back and slow their progress. But this is going to be a long, hard slog.
There are a lot of questions that still remain. One, and I know Senator Kennedy mentioned this, but the National Guard and the timeline that was there. I'd like for you to speak to that, if you can, the day of timeline, because I understand that Mayor Bowser spoke with the Secretary of the Army twice, at 1:34 and at 2:22, and with Chief Sun, he spoke with the Guard, the D.C. Guard Commanding General, at 1:49. And the Guard began to mobilize at 3, and the troops did not arrive until 5:40. Is that your understanding of the timeline?
Well, Senator, I appreciate the question. I'm glad you tied me back to my exchange with Senator Kennedy, because I fear that I may have contributed to a little bit of a muddle here. So first, let me say that my understanding is that on the question of authority, is that the D.C. mayor and the U.S. Capitol Police can ask for the National Guard, that the Secretary of Defense has the authority on federal land, the Secretary of the Army has authority on, in effect, D.C. or in when it's not D.C., state land. I really don't have the specifics on exactly who requested what and when. And I understand why it's a topic of keen interest, but I, as FBI director, am not intimately involved in that process, and so I don't want to add to any confusion that's out there.
Let me go to some of the riots that have taken place around the country and the crime that has seemed to spike this year. And previous to this, the FBI participated in Operation Legend. Of course, Memphis, Tennessee, was a part of that effort. So we thank you for that. But let me ask you, is the FBI tracking extremist groups like Antifa or other radicalism that are connected to violence in cities across the country, the violence and the looting that has taken place? And we know Operation Legend wound down and ended in January. So how is the FBI going to continue assisting local law enforcement in these cities where you have these riots that have taken place?
Well, Senator, I appreciate the question. I think you've touched on two very, very important but distinct topics. So one is the violence on our streets in a lot of our major cities, including Memphis, that that Operation Legend was designed to address. And the other is the violence that's occurring amidst protests, where otherwise peaceful protests are hijacked by people who engage in violent criminal behavior. So on the first, on what I would call sort of the more traditional violent crime side, the in effect Operation Legend side, if I can just use that as a shorthand, we do think that was a successful operation, but it was by its very nature finite in duration. What we're doing since then is trying to work with our Safe Streets task forces, which have representatives of state, local, and other federal agencies, and to try to bring a strategic, intelligence-driven approach to the violent crime problem. What I have found, and I've talked with state and local police chiefs in all 50 states, is that each city has its own idiosyncrasies. There may be certain common trends, but ultimately there's usually some kind of, in effect, tail wagging the dog that is contributing disproportionately to the violent crime problem in that community. And if everybody can be working together in an intelligence-driven way, they can prioritize the impact and dismantle the enterprise as opposed to just kind of pushing the problem around.
How are you tracking these anarchist groups who are planning attacks, who are occupying public spaces, and what type work are you doing to help protect communities from this?
So sure. So that's the second topic of the two that we touched on. So we do have a number of domestic terrorism investigations. We would call them anarchist violent extremism investigations into individuals, some of the most dangerous individuals involved in some of the conduct in particular over the summer. We are looking at everything from tactics to funding to logistics, and we're pursuing all available charges against them. I think I may have mentioned in response to an earlier question that last year in 2020, we arrested more anarchist violent extremists than the prior 3 years combined. But in addition, I would say that in some of the activity that you've described from over the summer, when it's targeting federal buildings, there are certain charges that may be available there, as was true with the courthouse in Portland and as is true, obviously, with the Capitol on the 6th. But when it comes to non-federal facilities, sometimes the charges end up being state and local charges where we work closely with and support our state and local partners as they bring charges. So we are continuing to move full speed ahead. We've increased significantly the number of investigations into the kind of activity you're describing, and we're going to keep at it.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer this episode is the intrepid Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo. You need to do your part to promote the Lawfare podcast. So tweet us, share us on Facebook, pin us on Pinterest, upvote us on Reddit, and for heaven's sakes, leave us a rating or review wherever you found us. The Lawfare podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free
or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.